Extraction number 14975, William Rochester, reel 12.
Mr. Rochester, reel 12. We were discussing on the last tape the response to the outbreak of war at the depot, Mr. Rochester. Were there any immediate changes which came about with the advent of war?
Well, not immediate, but towards the evening, things settled down again to more or less normal, as normal as you could get them, because I think some of the women had quite a shock. I mean, obviously everybody knew there was something going on, but to find that it was coming, it was actually on, was a shock for them all. And by the evening, I think things had settled down a bit, but some of the families moved out the following morning, the wives and the children, one or two of them moved out. There was still quite a lot left in the barracks. The thing that annoyed me a lot was my wife being told that if she didn't move out, the child would be taken from her. My son was born in April, and this was in September. He's about 6 months old or something. And some nit said that they would, if she didn't go, they would take the child away from her.
This was for safety, to keep the child safe, presumably.
This was for somebody, because he was a nit, and about safety. How safe could a child be with a strange people at that age? But nothing happened anyhow. She stayed there, and she stayed in there until we moved from there to Bransford.
You were, of course, a regular soldier, so the possibility of any kind of war was part of your profession.
True.
You say.
Yeah.
With the actual announcement of war, how did that affect you personally, knowing, of course, the implications of it?
Well, I think basically there was quite a few of us, and we're all there was five sergeants there, and we're all. So, and some of the sergeants, one or two of the sergeants, had been up in Razmak with having a bit of fun and games up there a few years previous to that, you see, in 1929, and they were up in Razmak, and they were shot at once or twice, not to go out. But we'd all talked to them in there. We got to know what it was like. We hadn't felt it or heard it, except being on the range, hearing the noise, shooting on the range. But I did a course before Montgomery went to Egypt, and I think that settled me down tremendously. I can't remember the call it was, but it was down the south of England. We're in there, and the whole squad was stood in a square, shoulder to shoulder, touching each other, squashed as much as you could, and on each corner there was an instructor stood. And then we were told that we were going to be fired at by live ammunition. If we stood perfectly still, nobody would be hurt. If anybody scampered, people would be hurt, because we can't stop it immediately, you know. And then the rattle started. God, and the soil was digging up about 6 inches in front of your toes when you're standing up here and shutting your eyes and listening, you know. And we found out then that there was about 8 machine guns all firing different around the square, right round, and there was a path all the way around, about 6 inches in front of you, and nobody was hurt. We all stood. I think we told her you better fight to stand when we saw these guns lined up, you know. But I think that gave you an instant, because first time we heard it when we went to France, I thought of that straight away. It's nowhere near me. It's not going to hurt me. And I think that put me in the right mood for war, because it never affected me, the noise or anything. And people dropping beside me, one or two dropped, I just looked at them and said to the next book, give an eye to him, because I had to go on with the people that was going. And I'm no different to anybody else, but I think that little bit of first shooting at me, it calmed me down and thought, well, it's missing me, the noise is there, I'll feel it when it hits me, you know, and that's the time to do something else there. I don't feel it's not going to hit me sort of sound, because you never know, it does, and it did.
So it was an experience in realistic well, conditions, almost realistic conditions.
It made me change, you know, because I never thought about what would happen when the war started until the last week or so. Everybody was talking about it. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. And it did happen, and all we had was the noise going and everybody running around like mad. Well, it wasn't everybody, it was just people out the married quarters, the women and all that. They were the ones that weren't told anything about it.
Was there any idea of what form the war would take? Did people believe they were going to be digging trenches and going over the top as they did in the First World War?
No, I don't think so. I think the instructors and all that realise it might have been a partially mobile one, because we've been listening and watching Germany, and they didn't dig trenches. They pushed and went straight through everybody, all the way through. And one or two, a couple of the old soldiers said, this is not like the last war. I didn't know what the First World War was like, except what I'd see digging trenches and walking around in water and things like that. But they had actually been there and seen it and done it and had been taking part in it. And the quick move of the German army, how they took countries and all that, they said that they're not digging, they're just pushing every way through, they're sloshing everything through with their tanks and that.
Was the initial expectation that the war wouldn't last long, over by Christmas kind of mentality?
Well, you got that impression at first. There's so many people saying, well, it'll be finished by Christmas, it'll be finished by Christmas. But there was that little circle that said, it'll be more longer than Christmas. Look what Germany's done in a few months. You know, they've got a force. We didn't have anything. We had people walking around on the coast with big broom shanks. They were going to sweep them off the cliff or something. That's what we used to say. Where's your head? You know, you can't sweep anybody with. You know, there was no ammunition. There was no equipment. We didn't have any equipment.
Yeah. Were there any changes in the training routine in the depot when after war started, or was it much the same as you had been doing?
Well, we carried on while we were at the depot at Newcastle. We weren't there very long. Then we moved to Bransworth, and everybody was clotted into Bransworth.
What date would this be?
It was in the December, I think. Somewhere in the December, we got out and we were at Bransworth. How they got them all in at Bransworth and where they were, I couldn't tell you. But we were under canvas, I know that. We were in the east side of the castle, before, not inside the castle at all. You know, on the east side of it, there was a few buildings there with a bunny shiny bricks that belonged to the castle, like the power stations and things like that were down there. We were under tents, under canvas down there for quite a while.
What were you doing down there?
Nothing much, just trying to get sorted out with the. We had territorial people who were sergeant majors and sergeants with us as well, and they were senior to us. We were told that they were senior to us. They'd been in the territorials for years and the rank and all that. We had to listen to them. Well, they were all civilians. They hadn't a ruddy clue what war was. I had a one that lived at the top of the street here. He couldn't light his cigarette, never mind anything else. It was terrible at the time. And
What rank did you hold?
A sergeant then, and I had a territorial sergeant major. He used to hide himself. You could never find him. You never saw him, never find him. And then we were only there a few weeks, two or three weeks, and then everybody was split up. They went to Spennymoor. Sections, groups went to Spennymoor. I went to Ashwinning, and there was another group went to the village before you get to Ashwinning. I can't remember what they call it, but we were up at Ashwinning. And we had five groups of 30s, five squads were at Ashwinning, and we had to go up and get buildings. Well, I was one of the people that went up to commandeer the buildings.
How did you do that? Because people, civilians, wouldn't expect you to walk in and say, hey, I want your
building. Yeah, well, we took a few army papers. I'd had a bit of practice at it when my son was born in the General Hospital in Newcastle. And there was only one day visiting day. Well, I didn't want to wait every week. I used to go up every day with an old army form to get signed. I didn't have the clue what it
was. So there was an official army requisition form?
No, there wasn't. There wasn't at the moment. We just thought we had to go up and say what we could do to get them. eye it out what we could get, you see. So there was three sergeants went up. Lackenby was one. I can't remember the other one. Charlie Lackenby was one. He was a senior sergeant. He eventually took over Sergeant Major there. And we went round and we saw cinema. We saw the cinema boss, little tubby fella. Tubby Roberts or something like that. Tommy might remember his name. But we went in and we talked to him about it, and we said, this is ideal for troops. It was on a bank. On the street went up a bank. And there was the corporate store was on the corner. There was like a bit of a square. And I said, well, look, there's a barrack square for us here. It must have been a schoolyard. I can't remember, but I remember the square. And the cinema, and that a billiard room upstairs, the cinema downstairs, then this Coop store on the corner. So I said, Charlie and I went round together, and I said, hey, this will be idea. You not get the cinema here with all the lads. So we can ask to get that, or get that one. We can have the upstairs room with the billiard tables out. Or if you like to leave them in, it'll be all right. They can sleep on or on the floor. We can have that shop for a cookhouse, you know, make a cookhouse store and that. Because there was a bit of a slaughter yard there where the corp used to slaughter the animals in the corner. Then we've got the barrack square. And then there was a couple of shops. One was empty, the next door belonged to Roberts, the man that had the cinema. So we said, oh, we'll have that as well. You'll get paid for it, you know. And we did pretty well. And so we just went back and reported it, and then somebody else would come up and say, right, that was, because within a few days we were marching up there and sorting yourselves out, march everybody on the square.
And the civilians took this okay, the fact that they were losing their businesses.
I think the powers that be would have been on to them before we moved, because it was perhaps a week or so after we'd been up having a look at places, and the railway line went past at the side, so it was quite good. And while we were up there, I got hold of a woman and find out about digs up there. And the only one we could get was above a fish shop. And so I wanted to bring my wife with me as well, because she was in digs, you know, she'd been in digs with us when we were in the other place. And we were there for about 3 days, and that was enough. We got somebody else. Somebody else came up to us and said, Sergeant, I believe you're sleeping in the fish shop. It was a new shop of the village, you know, and it was stinking of fish and chips and that. And, there's a woman up such and such a street. She's got a room. She'll take you in. So we got into that one. And it was quite good, actually, up there. But it didn't take as long to sort out and settle in a bit. And, of course, it was pretty handy. We did our training out on the bits of moors outside, and the training was patrolling, basically patrolling all the time.
With the normal training for drills and so on?
Oh, well, there wasn't a lot of drill training. You had to do something just to keep discipline in, because drill is the only thing that needs discipline. Except to fall down when you're told to fall down, and you do that when you're out on the moors. On the sloppiest, wettest place on the road, you shout down, and if they don't get down, there are 3 days chunkers, they don't go out. this was the way I worked. I mean, I don't know if it's right or not, but I thought it was right, because they had to learn to do that.
Had they done any drills prior to coming to you? Some basic work before they came to you?
Oh, yes, basic work at the depot. They were just about finished. They only had a few weeks to go before they went, because some of the lads left there and went to France. This is what I was worried about, you see. We'd had them as civilians at the depot for about 2 months or something. Then we moved, the war started, then we moved out to Bransworth Castle. Then from there, after they'd come away, we moved to Eshwinning. Well, their time was up, more or less, so we had to do what we could to get them done. Now, we were talking about other sergeants that were there, one or two, the older territorial sergeants, the lads would come in, we would go out, rain, snow, blow, we went out. Now, three or four of the squads would come back, absolutely soaking wet. And the other one would come back dry, or two, the other two would come back dry. Where the hell have you been? What have you been? They've been in a bloody barn, in a farm. You see? And, well, eventually we got rid of, all of them disappeared at the end. And we had regulars, we had all regular instructors, regular sergeants.
Those men who were finishing off their training with you, mm-hmm. you know, in your professional opinion, mm-hmm. were they equipped for war?
No.
What was lacking?
Time. Everything was done at a rush. Well, that's not the way to teach anybody. You've got to explain it to them, show them and demonstrate it to them, let them do it and practice it as much as possible so that they do it naturally and instinctively. I got some of the things, two or three of us got that, with the fact that we used to tell them that they're on patrol, and we used to take them on patrol, and then we'd throw these thundercrackers. And if there's an explosion or a bang goes off, the first thing you do is get flat on the ground, because then you're a smaller target. Then you can have a look around, and your corporal or your lance corporal can give you instruction to get up and get on again. He's going to watch and see what's happening and to get you good, because you go as a team, not only your section, the other sections, your platoon's a team, your section's a team, and work as a team. That was the thing all the way through, that you work, you don't individual, you're a team no matter where you are, what group you're in, that's a team, and you've got to look after each other in the team. We did that up on the hills at Eshwinden and that, and we did a little bit of map reading for them. For some reason or other, we had to do map reading, a little basic stuff, you know, given the march on a bearing and all that. So I used to go out during the day, at weekend or a weekend, and mark out a plot, an actual plot, because there'd been mines there, you know, these drift mines. And there was an awful lot of big holes where if you walked at night time, you can fall down them and be in trouble. So I used to go out during the daylight and make me angles from the actual place on the ground in so many paces, and I would send them out to do it. And to practice it, we did it in the daylight. We used to blindfold two or three of them, put a blindfold around them, with a man with each one of them. And he guided them which way to go, and then he said, now count the paces, so many paces. And then he would stop me and say, well, I've got to, this is my number to turn, and say, no, not quite, you've got to do some more. So you can get a better estimate with your blindfold from the distance to go. But this is for night. And then we would do night travelling, and we lost a company commander one night. He wouldn't come out with us at all. Well, he's only a lieutenant, but he knew everything. He'd been through the big school down in London, and he could do everything. And he wouldn't come out with us, and he followed us out one night, and he'd never come back.
What was his name?
Oh. Start with a B, I think. Burson, something like that. He's only a lieutenant, you know. And I can't remember. But
the men who were,
he didn't fit in at all.
The men who were coming to you would be conscripts, is that right?
Yes, more or less.
What was the quality of them?
Well, some of them were very good, actually. We had I had a squad at the depot. And basically, they were told to come and join up, as you say, called them conscript, but the majority of them had sort of been waiting to come. They knew they were going, and they were waiting to go. They just wouldn't volunteer, but they were waiting to go, to come in. And they were quite good, because the waiting time was over and done.
Did you have a weeding out role, even at this later stage of their training? Were you still weeding out those who weren't going to make it?
Well, they didn't like to get rid of people. There had to be something definitely wrong with them to get rid of them. I believe I told you once about a kid from Shields in the squad. He couldn't march. He couldn't dress himself even. The lad, somebody had to look after him. He couldn't make his bed up and his blankets up in the barrack room. And they were getting stopped and held back a bit. And he was one of the fellas that walked like that, you know. He could never keep in step, and the squad was held back.
And there was others like him from
You'd get the odd one or two. There wasn't a lot. You'd get the odd one or two that there's something wrong with them. One of them, you might find a bloke that's partially deaf. Nobody noticed it that he was deaf. He couldn't get an order. He'd turn the wrong way. Somebody shout an order out and he would go the wrong way.
So what you were doing really was finding them a place but not letting them go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they would have a role elsewhere but not in...
Well, we only got rid of two, I think, all the time I was at the depot. The powers that be took them away, but the other ones were employed elsewhere. It stopped a fit man doing it. If he was capable of doing the job there, he was told to do it. When I first went to the depot, there was quite a number of civilians working in the dining room, in the cook house, and places like that. You know, they were keeping the place tidy, and there were dining room orderlies and things like that. And funny enough, there were six of the twerps from my platoon in India when I went back as a sergeant. So, oh, look, he's come.
you said that you were basically doing patrolling, teaching them patrolling.
Yes.
Are there different types of patrol in the sense of a reactive patrol or reconnaissance patrol or listening patrol? We're doing the various aspects of patrol.
I think a patrol is a patrol, and we have to work by the book. So we had to study the book and work by the book. If we didn't work by that, we were wrong, because the book is always right. I mean, no matter what you put in or what you think, you've got to do it by the book. Now,
the book is
the instruction, the training book. I forget what they call it, a little red book. It's about that big little red book. And we had a sergeant, sergeant major, that could repeat that damn thing like book. We should get them up on the stage and say, come on, top, we get cracking. Let's have the first round. And he would rattle away. And he, hey, that's enough, I'm dry. He could rattle it off like a piece of pottery.
So the book laid down the various...
Basically the various things you had to do. And those were the things you had to do. You could put other little things in yourself. And Eshwinning was a good place to teach patrolling. And I mean, they were only youngsters. They had no idea of service life at all. And we used to take them up there, set them off, and there was a line there that took coal trucks and things across, you see, and there was a bit of a beck beside it. And I got up one day and I thought of something. I said, look, I got them on the other side of the bank. I was at this side of the river. And I said, I'm going to get away from here, and I'll see you up there, 50 yards up there, and I want you to spot me. If you spot me, shout and tell me you've spotted me. And they said, yes, they would. Well, the first time I went, I made a lot of noise, and one spotted me, and I shouted back, but I wasn't where he said it was. I found that out later, you know. And then I was spotted a couple of times, before I got there. So the next time I went up and do some more, and we used to practice and make them practice. Then there was a coal truck come along once. Well, he'd come along at about, 5 miles an hour, nice and slow. So I got a ride along with him. And, oh, how did you get there, sir? I never told them yet how I got there, but they were puzzling. They used to try hard to try and beat us to get across, hiding in things. And then there was quite a lot of pools of water, and one of the kids said one day when we come back, he said, we've come back dry, sergeant. I said, you always come back dry when it's not raining. He said, yes, but you've told us about no matter what the land's like, if you get an order to stand or fall or down, you're down, you've got to go, whether it's water, clouds, dirt, or just grass. I said, that's right. He said, well, you haven't done it yet. I said, well, you're not finished yet, are you? No. And I thought, you bugger. So there had to be a bombs, that would be cracker pots. So I borrowed about four lads from another squad. We got these sticks of bangers, you know, they're about that big, and you scrape the top and it smokes, and then throw them away. I got those out, and I placed them outside before my lot come. Took them out, and I said, now you're going to be here 20 minutes, half or so before mine come, and then I want you to throw these, you first, then every now and then you throw them off to see what happens. And I put them out and I made a lance corporal. He's put them into fours. So there was about six or seven of them in groups like that, you know, scattered about the place. And then the bombs started coming. And, you know, they went down. A lot of them went down. And I got them all. And I wanted to know, why had they done it? There wasn't a war on. We weren't at war. You knew we were training. But it sounded like an explosion. You know, it was an explosion, but it didn't affect you. It was only a make-do explosion. I thought you'd have reneged and stopped doing it. Oh no, we got to practice the thing right. You know, kids, they were nearly all kids, 19s and 18s and 20s, you know, the very most. That was 20 was a very high age for them, because they're nearly all 18s and 17s. And they told me that if you don't do what you're told when you first told it, you never remember it. You always remember the first thing you're told. So we tried. They had a group, you know, committee groups, and they used to come in, can we talk to you about something? I said, sure, come on. Seven or eight of them, or a section of them, would come in and discuss and argue with me about it. And we didn't think we should do this that way. We should do it another way. We'll try that when we go out. And I thought they were interested. And, you know, if you treat the kids properly, they'll do things properly. Not only will they do things properly, but they'll look after you as well. And I took that all through my training. And, well, it worked. Because if I'd been a real sod, I don't think I would have been here. Because they'd have just left me lying. And I couldn't move. I mean, I got back to the headquarters, fair enough. But with the help, I would have been sad. And we just treat everybody as people. Everybody didn't do that.
They would have a different attitude coming out of civil life than professional training.
You had to break it, you know. You had to give it to them and break it in. And get them to come and talk to you. If there's anything wrong, tell me. Come and say to me. Come and talk to me. If you're smashed, if you're hard up, you haven't got a couple to go and get a cup of tea, come and see me. Don't pinch it. Don't steal it off anybody else. Don't sit without something if you need it. Come and ask, and we'll see what we can do for you. And they used to. I mean, somebody would whip a pair of socks off them, or a pair of briefs, or something like that. You know, they'd go, somebody's done this, and I've lost this. All right, we'll see if we can find it. So we'd have a kit inspection. Put all the kits out there and then go around and look at the lot if you couldn't find it. I'll go up to the quartermaster stores, get a pair of ruddy socks off the quartermaster, give them. I said, shh, you've got them back. Don't tell anybody. And
you mentioned patrolling. Did you do night patrols as well?
Yes, you did night patrols as well. Up on the moors. But you did the night patrols away from those pits, you know, because they were dangerous. It was a bit of a hill. I don't know if you've been up that way, but you could go from Eshwini right over the top. Instead of going right round by the road, we used to walk over the top there, back again. But they were dangerous, those holes, because there was railway lines in, and sometimes the railway lines were just cut and they were bending up over. So how would they got them like that, I don't know. But you could look down the hole and see a railway line sticking up, where anybody falling there could be damn dangerous. We used to try and put signs around them, you know.
Did you have any accidents?
No. Just the colonel, just the company commander. We lost him, we left him there all night. And got him the next day. He took it all right. He couldn't get out. I couldn't get out the hole yourself.
How did they get on with the local people? You mentioned the fact that you were requisitioning things, which couldn't have been very...
I think they were all right. They're quite good. They went in Eshwini. They were all right. They were good. They were good for the village because they spent the money there. And it was only a little. It's only a small village. It was then, anyway. Only two or three shops, cake shops, and that. And they spent the money there. The fish shop was lovely. They got half the money, I think. But we were down further down. No, I can't remember what they call it. I never remember on the. down south towards Stockton, between Stockton and Hartlepool. We're in a big house there, and there's a fish shop just opposite us that I had digs in the just in the round the corner with an old lady there. Now there's a fish shop there, and the lads used to go across there, stand in the queue, and she would serve everybody but them, and then say there's nothing left, no fish left. Well, they did that one day, and one of the kids got really annoyed. I don't know whether I should say this or not, but never mind. He got really annoyed, so he undid his pants and jumped up on the counter and said, "Well, butter that bugger for you, for me, will you?"